This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's called the nuclear option. Yesterday, Senate Democrats threatened to change the rules allowing the minority to filibuster executive branch appointments. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was not pleased.
Now, it's pretty obvious Senate Democrats are gearing up today to make one of the most consequential changes to the United States Senate in the history of our nation. And I want everybody to understand this is no small matter we're talking about here. And I guarantee you, it's a decision that if they actually go through with it, they will live to regret.
In the end, filibuster rules were not changed. Instead, Democrats and Republicans reached a deal to begin votes on Obama administration nominations that had been previously held up. In exchange for Senate confirmation of President Obama's long-sought first director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Richard Cordray, and Senate votes on nominees to the National Labor Relations Board, the president will have to give up on Richard Griffin and Sharon Block, Democrats appointed during a 2012 recess. He has actually already done that. Those nominations were contested by Republicans, who said the Senate was not technically in recess and a case was in front of the Supreme Court. When it comes to the filibuster, Vermont's own Senator Bernie Sanders is well known. In 2010, he stood and talked for more than 8.5 hours, opposing President Obama's proposed deal to extend the Bush tax cuts. His filibuster garnered him a world of attention. His name was, for a time, the most popular term on Twitter. The text of his speech was printed in book format. And there's even an auto-tune song of him on the floor. You can actually listen to it on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. But Senator Sanders is also quite serious about how he thinks filibuster rules should be changed. We're going to talk with him about that and other topics in front of the Senate today on Vermont Edition. Senator Sanders joins me now from the Senate recording studio. It's a pleasure to have you back, Senator.
Good to be with you, Jane.
So tell me, do you think this agreement that was reached yesterday will have a permanent effect on the use of the filibuster in executive branch nominations?
Well, I think it's a step forward for a very limited aspect of what we do. I was a mayor for 8 years, and believe me, a chief executive officer, whether you're a Republican, Democrat, independent, progressive, conservative, has the right to have people around him or her who are part of their team. I mean, that's not a very controversial idea. So the president should be able, after he makes his nomination, to get his appointment voted on, up and down vote, as soon as possible. Republicans have not allowed that to happen. They have filibustered. They have delayed. So I am very glad that finally the president is going to begin getting some major department heads. Secretary of Labor will be voted on very shortly. We have the National Labor Relations Board people to be voted on very shortly. The head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, he was voted on yesterday. That's a step forward. But we would be kidding ourselves, Jane, if we thought that this agreement, as good as it is in getting the president his appointments, is going to solve the long-term dysfunctionality of the United States Senate.
Well, given that, do you think that then it's just about these nominations that were under debate that needed to move forward? I mean, what are we going to see when it comes to replacing Janet Napolitano, for example, in Homeland Security?
Well, right. That's right. But again, it's not just appointments. It goes without saying, I mean, in my view, that the president deserves to have his team. If the Republicans want to vote no, let them vote no. And a majority vote should carry. But the more important issue is this country today, as I think everybody understands, is facing enormous problems. Real unemployment is not 7.5%. It is 14%. Global warming is an enormous threat to our country and the entire world. We're looking at a campaign finance situation where billionaires can put hundreds of millions of dollars into campaigns, and the gap between the people on top and everybody else is growing wider. There's a real threat to the existence of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So we have enormous problems. And what the American people are saying to themselves is that they turn on C-SPAN or they read the papers and say, what are these guys doing? Where is the debate about how we create the millions of jobs that we desperately need? Where is the debate about how we make college affordable? Where is the debate about how we address global warming and cut greenhouse gas emissions? You know what? Virtually none of those debates are taking place. And the reason for that is that right now, you have a situation where the filibuster and obstructionism are taking place in an unprecedented way. Let me give you just one example. Between 1917 and 1967, 50-year period, there were 45 filibusters. Since Harry Reid, when Lyndon Johnson was the majority leader in the late 1950s for 6 years, I believe, he had to deal with one filibuster. Since Harry Reid has been majority leader in the last 6.5 years, he's had to deal with over 400 filibusters. Jane, we spend an enormous amount of time watching the clock tick for motions to proceed. The great debates are whether we can go forward on a piece of legislation, not even debating that legislation. So at a time when our country has so many huge economic and environmental and social problems, the American people are not seeing that type of debate, are not seeing that type of action, and they are profoundly disgusted.
Well,
and they should be.
How do you propose or what do you think would work to fix that, to get to those debates?
This is what I think. No question that both sides have historically abused the filibuster, but the Republicans, as I've just mentioned, have taken it to a whole new level. So one of two things has to happen. Either you go back to an agreement which says, okay, you know, yeah, Jane, if I wanted to leave the studio right now and walk to the floor of the Senate, I could bring the entire United States government to a halt. All I have to do is say, I object. No business takes place. 99 other senators could do the same thing. Does anyone think that that is a rational way for the United States government to be run? So one of two things happen. Either there is an agreement, which frankly I don't think will take place, in which we say, okay, we ain't going to do that anymore.
You mean a bipartisan agreement on filibuster changes? Is that what you mean?
I'm
you
saying don't think now, there will be an agreement? Gentle ladies agreement that you're not going to abuse the system.
Uh-huh.
And that is essentially what went on for many, many years. People could have filibustered, but they said, okay, only under extreme circumstances, if you like, only on some issue that is so important to me and my state, only then. And I mentioned 6 years of Lyndon Johnson as majority leader, one filibuster. Okay. And now under Harry Reid, over 400 filibusters, not even filibusters. These are demands for 60 votes to end debate. All right. So what's the solution? This is what I think the solution is. It's a fairly... Well, I wouldn't say it's a radical solution. It's the concept of what we call a talking filibuster. Here's the argument. People say, appropriately so, that the founders of this country did not want the Senate to be like the House where majority rules. That's what happens in the House. And in the Senate, the argument has always been that we have to protect minority rights. The process has got to be more thoughtful, move at a slower pace. And I agree with that. The debate is, what does minority rights mean? That's really what the debate is. Does minority right mean that when Barack Obama was elected by a pretty good margin to be president, when the Democrats, and I am an independent caucusing with the Democrats, control the House, control the Senate with a pretty good vote, we have 54, probably soon have 55, that we cannot pass legislation that the American people sent us here to do? Is that protecting minority rights or is that abusing majority rights? So what I think the solution is to say, okay, we are going to protect minority rights. If a member of the minority or the majority, anybody else, feels strongly about an issue and you want to go down on the floor, as you mentioned, I did it a few years ago. Senator Rand Paul did it more recently. Mm-hmm. You want to go down there, you want to speak for 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, you do it. And then your buddy feels strongly about the issue. He or she wants to come down and speak about it. You do it. And you got 10 of them you want to speak for a week. You do it. That's minority rights. And the minority should have the right to have amendments in important pieces of legislation. They can't be frozen out of the action. But at the end of all of that, you should not need 60 votes to pass legislation. You should need a majority vote, 51 votes. Now, what people don't know is that in recent years, actually, the Senate has passed a majority of senators have voted for some pretty good pieces of legislation to create jobs, to make some good changes in terms of campaign finance law, to protect equal rights for equal pay for women, to do away with loopholes that oil companies are getting, outrageous loopholes while they make all kinds of profits, and more. We got over 50 votes. Student loans. A lot of people are worried about student loans in Vermont, high interest rates. People don't know that a week or two ago, the Senate voted
A majority of the members of the Senate voted to maintain 3.4% interest rates on Stafford subsidized loans. But you know what? None of those pieces of legislation and a lot more ever went into law because while we got majority, we didn't get the 60 votes.
But you, so you know, you're in favor of those laws partly because you are, as you said, caucusing with the majority. So would you be pushing as strongly for this change if you were in the minority? If the laws that you were considering here might be passed were ones that you strongly disagreed right. with?
Well, that's a very fair question. And it goes without saying that if you require 60 votes, it means to say it is harder to get things done, meaning that if I'm in the minority, i.e. your point, and my Republican friends wanted to push through stuff that I disliked, I would be in a better position in the minority. That's true. That's true. But here's what we have to ask ourselves. What we have to ask ourselves is in a democratic society, when elections matter, when I go out and 99 other senators go out and they say, look, this is what I want to do, A, B, C, and D, vote for me. And they say, hey, this is dysfunctional. You can't do anything. Nobody can do anything. So what you're asking me is if what I am proposing is more will have an impact on those people in the minority and what happens if I am in the minority, yes, that is true. But I have got to have the confidence that the views that are
We're talking today with Senator Bernie Sanders. Little blip on the line there. We'll get him back in just a moment. We're talking about the filibuster right now. Senator Sanders has been very vocal about how he thinks the filibuster should be used, a speaking filibuster, as he did in 2010, as he mentioned, Senator Rand Paul conducted just a few months ago. And we're looking at what the changes should be. Listeners, if you have questions for Senator Sanders, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Senator, we've got you back there. And let me take this opportunity then to interrupt you to say, you know, I just want to push you on that because in 2005, we did see proposed changes to the filibuster rule, but it was a switch. It was the Republicans trying to change the rules and some of the Democrats who are now wanting to change the rules were the ones saying, no, 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 that's not fair. And the Democrats, the Republicans, forgive me, were saying the opposite of what they're saying. So how should we have any faith that anybody who's is going to have that same opinion when the tables are turned?
That's a very fair point. And as I indicated before, have Democrats, and again, I'm an independent, but have Democrats, and much of this took place before I was in the Senate, because since I've been in the Senate, Democrats have been the majority. Have the Democrats abused the system? Yes, they have. No question about it. All that I'm saying is Republicans have taken it to a whole new level, and we have a dysfunctional situation right now. So, I think that right now, being in the majority, and nobody knows what's going to happen in the next Senate, who's going to control it? It looks pretty close. Might be the Republicans, might be the Democrats. I think right now, for that reason, because no one knows who's going to control the Senate, it's probably a pretty good time for people to sit down and say, look, we don't know who's going to be in charge next time, but what we have now is dysfunctional. Let's make sure we protect minority rights. Absolutely. But you got to have something where the majority can do something, which is not happening right now. And I think what bothers me, it's not even this or that issue. It's not just unemployment or the gap between the rich and everybody else or Social Security. It's that people are giving up on the political process and they're saying, you guys, what are you talking about? What are you doing? So that's my concern, Jenny.
Can I ask you one clarifying question and then we'll move on to other topics because we've got some listeners who want to ask you about things that are happening in front of the Senate and a lot to talk with you about. But, you know, most filibusters aren't like what you did with the talking filibuster for 8.5 hours or what we saw with Senator Rand Paul filibustering the president's nomination of John Brennan as CIA director. Can you explain how the filibuster got so out of whack?
That's right. You're absolutely right. When people think of filibusters, you know, they think of Mr. Smith goes to Washington or maybe me or Rand Paul. That very rarely happens. What it means, if Bill comes up, I say I'm going to put a hold on the bill, or in other words, all that you're doing now, 99% of the time, is to say I want debate to continue, which means that we can't get off the bill. you're going to have to get 60 votes to get off of this bill so that you can vote for final passage. And I'm demanding that you get 60 votes or else we're going to continue debate. So the majority leader has a bill. Say it's student loans. We voted, majority voted for to keep it at a low interest rate. The minority says you needed 60 votes to finally get final passage voted on that bill. Otherwise, we're going to keep debating it week after week after week. So the majority leader says, okay, I don't have 60 votes. I got to take the bill off the floor and I'm bringing up something else. So for all intent and purposes, they won that because we did not have 60 votes. That's how it works 99% of the time.
So you'd really like to change cloture rules?
Yes.
And the filibuster, would you want to require that to be a talking filibuster?
I think that people should be, they have to be present, and they can't just say, I'm putting a hold on something. They got to be down on the floor, and they have to be talking. And it needn't be one person. Other people can be down on the floor as well. So the minority should have as much time as they want to allow the American people to focus on their concerns. That's power. But you just – I'll give you one example.
Sure.
There was an issue, I think it was a hold, where some guy said, I want 60 votes. It was on a Thursday night. People had appointments, members of the Senate appointments all over the country. They had to stay, I think it was the Saturday, to finally get the 60 votes, which they got. The guy who put the hold was back home in his own state. He didn't even bother to stay. I'll give you another example of how rules are abused. I'm an advocate of a single-payer health care system. It does not have a lot of support in the Senate. Number of years ago during the Affordable Care Act debate, I wanted at least a vote on the bill. First time ever a vote on a single-payer system. I guess that would have gotten 7-8 votes. A Republican said, we're not going to have a vote on that. I want the clerk to read the entire bill. It's a long bill. It would have been 16 hours to read it. To tie up the entire Senate in the middle of a health care debate for 16 hours, I was asked to withdraw the bill, and I did. Because somebody demand that's, in, to my mind, an abuse of the rules. And that's what is going on now in terms of obstructionism.
All right. We're talking with Senator Sanders today. He's been a vocal proponent of changing the rules surrounding the filibuster. And those issues, as you well know, came to the fore yesterday as the Senate made a deal to move forward on some Obama administration nominees. Listeners, got questions for the senator on a range of topics? He's with us this hour. Happy to take your calls at 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions and thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. We've been looking at filibuster rules and what the senator would like to see changed. Here is Senator Sanders midway through his filibuster in 2010, talking about General Electric.
When GE recently had a couple of years ago some really difficult economic times, they needed $16 billion to bail them out. I didn't hear Mr. Inmel going to China, 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 China. I didn't hear that. I heard Mr. Inmel going to the taxpayers of the United States for his welfare check. So I say to Mr. Inmel, and I say to all of these CEOs who have been so quick to run to China, that maybe it's time to start reinvesting in the United States of America.
Senator Bernie Sanders filibustering in 2010, partway through his 8.5 hours of talking, protesting Bush-era tax cuts that were scheduled to be reinstated and were. Listeners, if you have a question for the senator about filibuster rules or anything else the Senate is looking at, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Anne is on the line from Heartland. Hi, Anne. Go right ahead.
Hi. I have been following the revelations about the surveillance on the secret courts pretty carefully, and I'm pretty disturbed by this. And I'm wondering, aside from encrypting our emails, what can the public do to get a broader focus on this so that some action happens and the issues of secret courts and secret rulings and surveillance is addressed?
Yeah, Anne, thanks for the call. Senator Sanders?
Well, that is – thanks for the call, Anne. And that is an issue that I think a whole lot of Vermonters are very, very concerned about and should be concerned about. Here's what you got. I should say that at the outset that I voted against the original USA Patriot Act, and I voted against the reauthorization of it, and I voted again against it. And my fear from the very beginning is that we were giving the government much too much latitude to go after innocent Americans. And I have tried and will continue to try to change what is called Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act. And in English, not legalese, here's what the issue is. I think all of us want law enforcement or the intelligence agencies to be able to go after people who are terrorists. I think we all want that. I certainly do. And that means that if law enforcement or the FBI or the NSA believes that somebody is involved in terrorist activity, what they should be doing is going to the FISA court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, and going in there and saying, look, judge, here are the reasons why I believe that Mr. Z is involved in terrorist activities. Make your case. And the judge says, well, you've made a compelling case. That's a good point. Now you have the authority to do what you need to do. But if the FBI goes in and say, hey, this guy was involved, wrote a letter to the editor, was involved in a demonstration, we want to tap his phone, I would hope the judge says no. He or she is exercising his constitutional rights. You got to have a reason to go after somebody. Now, what we have learned recently is that every telephone call, virtually every telephone call being made in this country is being filed by the NSA. When you made the call and the number that you called. We also know now that the NSA is able to get into the websites that you visit. 99.99% of the people whose phone calls are on file have absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. So I am going to work as hard as I can, probably during the Department of Defense authorization bill, to work with other senators who have similar concerns to reform Section 215 so that the intelligence agencies cannot be filing everybody's phone calls or getting into our websites. I worry very, very much about the future of this country, not only with the government doing that, but also increasingly with corporate America doing that, so that you end up with corporations, private companies who know the prescription drugs that you are using, where you are shopping, what websites you are visiting. And for all those people who talk a whole lot about freedom and liberty, that doesn't sound like the America we want to become. So we have got to pay a lot more attention to privacy. I'm going to be working hard on the USA Patriot Act to prevent the government from doing what it currently is.
Well, given your opposition to the government doing what it currently is and your frustration with finding out that the government is doing this, Flask wants to know, what are you doing to help John Kiriakou, Bradley Manning, and Edward Snowden? Of course, people who have come out talking about government surveillance and government operations. Flask says, what are you doing to see that the perpetrators of these acts and not the whistleblowers go to prison?
I believe absolutely that we have to protect whistleblowers. On the other hand, as Snowden fully made clear, he knew that he was breaking the law, and you can't condone that as well. He will have to, if he goes before a trial, I don't know what's going to happen to him, he will have to make his case that what he was doing was in the best interest of the United States of America. He knowingly did it, and he will hear what the jury has to say.
Well, what do you think? Should he go to jail?
That's the decision. I mean, one of the interesting things is that's what trials are about. So I'm not going to try the man without the trial. He will make his case, and I and the American people will hear his defense. Certainly, what he has revealed is important for us to know.
Let's go to Matt in Norwich while we're on this topic. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
I think I've just been redundant, and I was going to ask the question whether Senator Sanders thought that Snowden was a whistleblower or basically an American hero. And I guess your idea is that a jury should decide that. Is that right?
Well, my idea, it's not my idea. Snowden broke the law. Snowden took an oath of secrecy and he intentionally broke the law. Martin Luther King Jr. broke the law. Sometimes people break the law and they make their case to the public and the public says, thank you very much. Sometimes they don't. So I think what has to happen, what may happen with Snowden, is there will be a process in which he will be tried by his peers. But having said that, let me also say that I think the revelations that came out from Snowden were extremely important, and their revelations that I am going to act on along with other members of the Senate.
So in a sense, are you saying even if he does go to jail, what he revealed was worth revealing it, but he may have to pay the price for it?
That's right. Yes.
We're talking today with Senator Bernie Sanders, talking about a lot of issues that are coming before Congress right now. And listeners, if you have questions for Senator Sanders, if you want to talk about student loans, you want to talk about immigration, you want to talk about other issues that the senator is dealing with in Washington, now's the time to give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post questions on our webpage. Go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition. You can post a question right there. Senator Sanders, let's talk a little bit about student loans. I know this is something that you've been very vocal about. And I want to take you back to earlier in our conversation today where you mentioned that conversations aren't happening. And we can get into the actual substance of the student loan issue as well. But that seems like a conversation that is happening. I'm just curious whether you think it's not happening enough on the floor of the Senate or on the floor of the House in this case. But it does seem to be happening. You know, we're hearing about it in the news. We know where Republicans stand on this issue. We know where Democrats stand on this issue. Isn't that a conversation that is happening? Is it just not in the right place?
Well, it's happening because by law, the 3.4% interest rates on Stafford subsidized loans expired, and they jumped to where they are right now to 6.8%. So when that happened, that brought forth debate and legislation in the Senate and the House. So there was debate.
Mm-hmm.
There is not enough debate, by the way, Jane, in terms of the overall cost of college education, whether it is a good thing for our country that on average, young people in the state of Vermont are graduating college $28,000 in debt on average, which means the lower income kids are graduating even more in debt. And if you go to medical school or dental school, you can be $200,000 plus in debt. And I don't think that debate has certainly taken place. But here's what the issue is. If we believe that we need a competitive workforce, we need a well-educated workforce in this very competitive global economy, do we want to make it difficult for low and moderate income families to be able to send their kids to college? And what's happening today, hundreds of thousands of young people are saying, you know what? I'd love to go to college, but I don't want to come out $50,000 or $60,000 in debt in this economy. I think that makes no sense at all. Now, you may recall a few months ago, we had the ambassador from Denmark come to Vermont, do some town meetings with me. In Denmark, people go to college regardless of their income. They don't pay a penny out of their own pockets. A number of countries do that. Other countries partially subsidize college education a lot more than we do. So that's the overall issue. Do we see college and graduate school as an investment for the future of America in terms of getting the best educated workforce we can, or should we put that burden on families, many of whom can't afford it, and we lose the intellectual capital that a well-educated population could give us? So I obviously think that we have to do two things. Number one, the government has got to be more active in making college affordable. Second of all, we do have to deal with the reasons why college education is so expensive in this country, much more expensive than any other country on earth.
So given that's where you'd like to see the debate go, but it isn't there right now. The debate, the one that we're having anyway, in the halls of Congress, at least, is about the student loan rate. Is that enough if we set the student loan rate at 3.4%, made that permanent? Would that end the debate for you? I mean, is that the best that you could get at this point?
Nope, it wouldn't. I mean, for a start, what we have to understand is the government itself recently has been borrowing, because interest rates are low, over a 10-year period, have been making well over $100 billion in profits from low and moderate income families who are paying not just 3.4%, that's just for the subsidized. It's a lot higher than that for the unsubsidized or for the PLUS loans. I don't think that makes a lot of sense. But overall, I think the issue is how do we create a situation where anybody in this country who has the ability and the desire can get a higher education? Not everybody needs 4 years or wants 4 years. But to say to people and families that because you don't have the money, your kids can't go to college seems to me unfair to those families and unfair to the future of the United States of America. So it's a big debate. The higher education bill is going to be reauthorized next year. I'm on that committee, and we're probably having some meetings in the state of Vermont to get people's ideas about how we can best go forward.
Senator Sanders, we got a note from Marie who says, I have worked as an Army civilian for over 28 years and through no fault of my own have to take 11 furlough days. That's 88 unpaid hours by 30th of September this year. That's due to the budget sequester that has fallen off everyone's radar screen. In addition, we have not had a pay increase for 3 years, plus our retirement benefits are under scrutiny for cuts as well. Fiscal year 2014 begins in October, and from what I have read and heard, the Department of Defense funding situation will only get worse, potentially resulting in job elimination. Marie says, I am so discouraged. It's difficult to focus on my work or even to show up for work. For what it's worth, I want you to know that real people are struggling emotionally and financially. And Marie concludes by saying, by the way, she's actually on furlough today. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I agree with what Marie said. The sequestration process was a disaster. And as a colleague of mine pointed out recently, it was such a stupid idea. It was developed to be such a stupid idea that the thought was that it would not take place. Because nobody thinks just doing across-the-board cuts. If you have to cut, you cut judiciously. There are higher priorities and lower priorities. And laying off people or furloughing people certainly would not have taken place if people had flexibility. But here's what the issue is, and I want to back it up because it impacts not just Marie, and that is a tragedy, no question about that. And Marie, I am more than aware that federal employees have not gotten a wage increase in years, and I am more than aware that there are some people, some of my Republican friends, who want to go after pension programs as well. But what sequestration has also done is made it harder for fragile senior citizens who get Meals on Wheels. People are just barely hanging on. They've cut back on Meals on Wheels. Working families who are sending their kids to Head Start, we lost, I believe, 70,000 slots for Head Start. Nutrition programs have been cut back. So this has been a real tragedy for the country. But let me explain how this takes place. There is a very fundamental philosophical divide between the Republican, right-wing Republican House now, and the Senate. I voted for, I'm a member of the Budget Committee, a budget that passed the United States Senate that would have done away with sequestration. And the reason that it would have done away with sequestration and help us move toward deficit reduction is because it brought in new revenue. And it brought in new revenue by asking large corporations, one out of four of which are paying zero in taxes right now, to start paying their fair share of taxes, ended the absurdity of these tax havens in the Cayman Islands by which we're losing, where corporations stash all of their profits in the Cayman Islands, don't pay a nickel in taxes on that. So that's what some of us said, that we don't want sequestration, we don't want workers to be furloughed, we don't want Head Start kids to lose their ability to get an early childhood education, etc. But we do want the wealthiest people and largest corporations doing phenomenally well to start paying their fair share. Now, over in the House, what these guys said is the only thing that they want, they don't want a nickel more in revenue. The only thing they want are cuts, 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 and cuts. Cuts in Medicaid, transformation of Medicare, which amounts to a cut, moving toward cuts in Social Security, in nutrition. And you finally reached the point where the two sides could not agree, and sequestration became the process.
So that is where we are. What now? Yeah, what now?
Well, what now is this country – I don't think it's – I was going to say the country is divided. I don't think that's true. The Congress is divided. Jane, where we are right now is, I believe very strongly, that the American people have said in every poll that I have seen – that at a time when the wealthy and large corporations are doing phenomenally well, they have got to be asked to pay their fair share of taxes. Who thinks it makes sense for corporations to make billions of dollars in profits and not pay a nickel in taxes? And then, because of that, the cut, throw Marie out of work for sequest her, or throw older people off the older off of the Meals on Wheels program. But what you have right now, and this is what, you know, people say, well, you know, government, I hate politics. This is what it's about. You have people in the House who are very right-wing people who believe, who are there, in my view, to protect the wealthy and the powerful, and they are prepared to make savage cuts in programs.
But that's not quite fair to the argument, is it? I mean, there are economic arguments about job creation, about the role of business in fostering job creation. And you know, you may disagree about how that should be done, but it's not just let's nickel and dime the people who don't have money and let's let corporations off scot-free.
Jane,
that's not exactly what people are saying.
Well, that's probably not the way they would phrase it, Jane. I agree with you that. But if you look at the Ryan budget, and at some point, if you'd like to sit down and discuss the Ryan budget, we can. Massive cuts in Medicaid. Transformation of Medicare. The Republicans just passed last week the farm bill. You're familiar with that.
Yes.
And they forgot to include in the farm bill 80% of the funding of the farm bill, which deals with nutrition programs because they want to make savage cuts in food stamps. That's a fact. So, you're right in saying the Republicans would phrase it in a different way. They would say, if we give huge tax breaks to the wealthy, blah, 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 it's going to result in trickle-down economics, and we're going to create all these wonderful jobs. And there are some people who believe in that. I don't. Fair enough.
Hey,
but objectively speaking, what I'm telling you is the truth. Their proposals would make massive cuts in programs that low-income and moderate-income people depend upon.
We're talking with Senator Sanders. Senator, we've got to take a quick break. Then we'll come back for a couple more minutes, a couple more topics we want to discuss. Listeners, you can post your questions at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Senator Bernie Sanders is my guest today. We've been looking at filibuster rules. We've been talking a little bit about student loans. Been talking about other issues facing the Senate right now. And listeners, we've got a couple minutes left with him. If you have a question, post it on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Got a question from Chris in South Burlington, echoing some other people who've been writing in, Senator, who, as I'm sure you know, want to talk to you about the F-35 program. Chris says, why have you refused to meet with the thousands of your constituents who live in South Burlington and Winooski who are facing destruction of their home values due to your support of the F-35 fighter jet? Even if you disagree with these constituents and prefer to support Lockheed Martin's out-of-state profits over protection of their homes and health, don't they deserve a meeting?
Well, we have met, and my staff has met, and Leahy and Welch's staff has met with them as well. But here's the point.
But just in terms of the way that feels to people, that's different, isn't it? Having your staff
meet. The answer is, Jane, if you do one meeting, there'll be a demand for another meeting. Let me just say one word on the F-35.
Sure.
Okay. The issue is not to me the F-35. The issue to me is the Vermont National Guard. It is very, very likely, almost definitely, that the F-35 will be the cutting-edge fighter plane for the Air Force, the Marines, the Navy, and the Army, and for NATO allies. That is the reality. The issue is, does the Vermont National Guard continue its mission, or does it not? If the F-35 does not come to Burlington, Vermont, and I understand there are many people who don't want it, there are many people who do want it. If it does not come to Burlington, Vermont, it will surely go someplace else. So this is not a debate about the future of the F-35. It's a question of whether it comes to Burlington. If it does not come to Burlington, I don't know. I'm not going to sit here and make a prediction about what it means. It is very possible it can mean the loss of many hundreds of jobs.
That's something that the Vermont Guard is not prepared to say. The last time we had the Adjutant General on, he stepped back from that and said, look, we don't have another mission coming up, but we cannot say this will result in job cuts.
That's correct. That is right. It may. The answer is if they get another mission, of course, there may not be any job cuts. But when you lose your major mission, which is deploying a cutting-edge fighter plane, certainly there may be a loss of jobs. We don't know what the future is. So you're right. But it could very well be a loss of jobs. And I choose not to face that risk. So that's my view on that. There is an issue. If I could switch gear for one second, Jane, I'm happy to answer. We've been talking a lot of a lot of fairly dispiriting issues. I wonder.
You want to talk about what you want to talk about now? Fine. Go ahead, Senator.
No, go ahead.
I'm joking with you. Go ahead. What do you want to talk about?
Okay. What I did want to mention is some nice news I think is coming to the state of Vermont. For those folks down in the Springfield area, as a result of federal funding, you are now getting the fastest broadband service in the United States of America. I think Google has a project in Kansas City equally fast, about 100 times faster than what is normally the case. That will, in the next couple of years, we expect that Springfield and I think a dozen towns in that area will have the fastest broadband in America and in the world, I believe. And that has great potential for economic development in that area. Also, as a result of federal funding through the stimulus package, we are going to see broadband, not the fastest in the world, but 4G wireless broadband in virtually every community in the state of Vermont. And what is very exciting is the potential there, not only for improved education and healthcare services, but also for economic development. Because what it means, if you're a small business and you'd love to settle in the state of Vermont in a small town, you may not be able to do it now because the quality of the broadband is not where it should be. And if you have high-quality broadband, we can bring economic development to areas in the state which normally don't see that. So I'm very excited about that. Some progress has been made in the next few years. Our hope is that Vermont literally can lead the country, be number one in terms of the quality of our broadband access.
All right. Glad you mentioned that. We did want to get to broadband. And let's give the last words to our callers. Jonathan's on the line from Ferrisburg. Hi, Jonathan. Go right ahead.
Hello. Senator, I have a question about there was some mention of the Farm Bill. I come from a small farming family in Ferrisburg, been there since 1803. And we're running into some trouble there, of course, keeping the farm viable in its much smaller form currently. I was wondering if there's anything that you or other senators were considering for assistance for small farmers in
Jonathan, is this a dairy? Are you a dairy farm?
It was formerly a dairy farm. It is now the largest commercial hop farm in the state of Vermont, a whole whopping 1.5 acres.
All right. So Jonathan's growing hops instead of making milk, Senator?
The answer is yes. I think in the Farm Bill that passed the Senate, there was an emphasis on protecting family-based agriculture. There was a very important provision to deal with the volatility of milk prices. I know Jonathan is not now a dairy farmer, but to give dairy farmers the ability to purchase inexpensive insurance to protect them when prices go down, there is significant support in that bill for organic agriculture to make it easier for people to purchase locally produced food. One of the revolutions that is taking place, I think, in Vermont and around the country is the desire of people to purchase food locally through CSAs, through farmers markets. And I think the bill gives some support to those efforts.
Yes, but do you think it can pass? We saw the House split the bill so that there's agriculture, there's now SNAP and food stamp benefits in a separate package. I mean, is there any resolution to that? It doesn't sound like the Senate's going to go for that.
Well, the Senate will certainly not go for that bill. Debbie Stabenow, who's the chair of the Agriculture Committee, indicated that if they go to conference, she thinks there is a reasonable chance. Of course, the nutrition programs will be put back in. She is of the opinion that something can happen. And
just
I hope she's right.
Very quickly, again, one more listener, Rabia in Norwich, says you speak in favor of support for food stamps, but you keep voting for bills that decrease the amounts given. She says there's an across-the-board cut coming in November. Put your vote where your mouth is and stop voting to decrease food stamp support.
Well, I did put my vote where my mouth is. I voted for the amendment. You know, in the real world, what happens is you have a bill. I could have voted against the entire farm bill, which I think would have been a stupid vote. There was an amendment that said no cuts. The Senate wants the Senate bill cuts without going into all the details. It would not impact Vermont to the best of my knowledge. About $4 billion. Senate wanted to do $20 billion. I voted for an amendment that would do away with all cuts for the food stamp program.
Senator Bernie Sanders speaking to us today about a lot of issues coming before the Senate. Thank you very much for being on the show today, spending the hour with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
If you still have thoughts on today's program, please share them with us. You can post your thoughts at vpr.net, or you can continue the conversation that's ongoing on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Now, we just got a call from a hop farmer. Jonathan's going to want to make sure he listens to tomorrow's show. It's all about beer. Vermont has the most craft breweries per capita in the country, and it's home to one deemed the best in the world. We're going to learn about why Vermont has been such a good incubator for microbreweries and brew pubs, and why the list of beer makers continues to grow. Let us know about your favorite Vermont brews on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, and tune in for the conversation tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson and Annie Pruitt. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.